Director William Friedkin's movies, The Exorcist, The French Connection, are considered classics. But when he directed them in the 1970s, he was breaking all the rules. In his new memoir, William Friedkin describes how he brought a new look and new feel to Hollywood films. NPR special correspondent Susan Stamberg visited the Oscar-winning director at his home in Bel Air, California.
As a kid in Chicago, William Friedkin liked to frighten little girls with scary stories. When he grew up, he scared the rest of us with a little girl who becomes possessed by the devil.
Mother, what's wrong with me?
It's just like the doctor said, it's nerves, and that's all.
Director Friedkin also put knots in our stomachs with one of the great movie chases. In his memoir, The Friedkin Connection, the 77-year-old director tells how he made those movies. We'll get to some of that in a bit, but first, the first movie that inspired him as a young man. Director-actor Orson Welles' classic, Citizen Kane.
I went in at noon. I watched it five times that day, and I couldn't believe it. When I came out, it was like standing in front of a Vermeer or a Rembrandt. That's the effect it had on me.
Rosebud. Before Kane, movies were just entertainments for Friedkin. Kane was something different.
I didn't know what the hell it was, but that's what I wanted to do.
After many starts, stops, and career bumps, William Friedkin began making vivid, original movies. 1971, The French Connection. Gritty New York cops tracking a heroin smuggle. A feature film done in documentary style, rough, raw, real, no special effects. Quick cuts and that car chase. Friedkin and his producer and partner Phil D'Antoni knew they needed a big chase scene, but what? How? They decided to take a walk down Park Avenue.
And not stop walking until we had spitballed a chase scene.
They started grabbing ideas out of thin air.
What if the bad guy is out to assassinate the cop?
The bad guy runs. The cop chases him.
Where do they go?
What if the bad guy runs up the stairs to an elevated train platform? And how about the cop chases the train in a car?
Please, come on, Dad, I need a car.
Careening around pedestrians, crashing his way under the elevated tracks, the spitball walk down Park Avenue was getting exciting.
We walked 55 blocks in one direction, and we wound up on a traffic island, and we embraced each other because we had the chase.
Then they had to figure out how to do it. A guy at New York's Transit Authority said it would be very difficult to give permission to film on a train. Friedkin and D'Antoni thanked him and started to leave.
And the guy said, just a minute. He said, I told you it was going to be very difficult, but not impossible. And without a hesitation, D'Antoni said, what would it take? And the guy said, $40,000 and a one-way ticket to Jamaica. And I asked him, I said, why one way? And he said, because if you make this picture with that scene the way you've described it, I will be fired and I want to go down there and live.
Friedkin screened The French Connection for Elmo Williams, a former big-deal film editor who was temporarily running 20th Century Fox.
The screening ended, and he said, well, it's got some good things in it, but that scene where the cop is frisking the guy, cut 6 frames off of that. And then he'd go to another shot and say, add 3 frames to that. And this went on throughout.
Elmo wanted to see the revised film in a week, but Friedkin thought Elmo was full of it and decided not to change a thing.
We showed him the exact same picture. He had a few more notes, and then the lights went up and he said, well, it's certainly improved, fellas. You've certainly made it better.
Are you comfortable, Reagan?
Yes.
How old are you?
12.
Is there someone inside you?
Sometimes.
William Friedkin's 1973 film, The Exorcist, told a based-on-real-life story of demonic possession of a young girl. Now, in its 40th anniversary year, The Exorcist still has the power to chill, especially when the demon speaks through the girl.
Did you do that?
Actress Mercedes McCambridge voiced the demon's lines. Getting that voice involved considerable pain and suffering for the actress. Friedkin knew her work from old-time radio drama and her Oscar-winning performance in the 1949 film All the King's Men.
Good evening, Governor Stark. I thought you might like to know that Judge Stanton kept his promise. He gave the story to every paper in town.
McCambridge, a staunch Catholic who'd quit smoking and fought her alcoholism with help from AA, knew what she would need to turn her rich, gravelly voice into Friedkin's demon. Two priests in the studio at all times, and her hands tied behind her back.
She wanted to sit in a position of being tortured. She wanted to drink raw eggs. She wanted quantities of Jack Daniels and cigarettes. It must have taken about a month, at least, to record one word at a time, one sentence at a time. And as she was recording, her voice would take on a strange quality. She would breathe into the microphone, and you'd hear two or three different sounds coming from her throat. And she saved the movie.
William Friedkin, creator of scary, gritty, macho films, ends his book, The Friedkin Connection, with a tranquil memory from his Chicago childhood.
I used to ride my three-wheeler bike as fast as I could along Sheridan Road, past the furniture outlet, the little grocery store, the movie theater.
He remembers the scarf wrapped around his nose and mouth, the blur of passers-by and pigeons scattering.
My world always ended at the shore of the frozen Great Lake, watching the ice floes, jagged pieces of a big white puzzle breaking in the sun. No worries then about what lay ahead. Everything would be fine, and soon I'd be in the warmth of our one-room apartment, drinking the hot chocolate my mother made, listening to one of my favorite radio programs, waiting for my father to come home from work.
It could be a scene from a movie, right? What else, really, from a legendary Hollywood director? I'm Susan Stamberg, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Alyssa Block. It's time for the Backseat Book Club, our regular feature for our youngest listeners and the adults in their lives. Every month, we ask kids to read a book along with us. But before we get to that special book, we first have to spend some time acknowledging a very special movie based on this month's pick. Our colleague Michelle Norris explains why.
We're going to spend some time with the big screen first, because that's usually what comes to mind when you mention The Wizard of Oz.
Off to see the wizard, the wonderful Wizard of Oz. We hear he is a wizard of wiz, if ever a wiz there was.
It's safe to say that most Americans are familiar with the classic film and the image of the stumbling scarecrow, the rusted tin man, the cowardly lion, and Dorothy, played by the actress Judy Garland, clad in gingham and braids. Over the years, The Wizard of Oz has been a popular and profitable franchise, producing toys, Halloween costumes, ruby slipper replicas, and several spin-offs, including a film called The Wiz. That 1978 Motown musical was an urbanized version of Dorothy's visit to the Land of Oz, featuring an all-black cast and music by Quincy Jones. The Backseat Book Club is going back to where the Yellow Brick Road began with the original book that started it all. First published more than 100 years ago, it was an immediate hit. The author L. Frank Baum was a jack-of-all-trades businessman who lived all over America, and he loved telling bedtime stories to his children. And few know more about Baum and his Oz books than Michael Patrick Hearn. Among other things, he's the editor of The Annotated Wizard of Oz. He joined us from New York to tell us more about why he's so obsessed with all things Oz.
Oh, I think it was just the sense that a child can go to this other place where all kinds of adventures, and you never know what's going to happen next. It just captured my imagination. Those strange characters, the strange things that happened. But it always was from a child's point of view. You always saw what happened in Oz through Dorothy's eyes. So you're traveling with that child and seeing all these wonders as she's discovering them.
Why Oz? Why the word Oz? Because if it was the Wonderful Wizard of Id or the Wonderful Wizard of, you know, any almost anything else, it just wouldn't have that kind of magic. Oz is just perfect.
Well, that was really an accident. Baum himself said that he was trying to find a name, and nothing came to him. And he was looking around his study, and he looked at a filing cabinet. And there were three drawers, A to G, H to N, and O to Z. And that's where the word came from.
Isn't it amazing where inspiration can come from?
Exactly.
Many people will easily migrate toward the film because it's everywhere. Why is it worth it to go back to the original book and read The Wizard of Oz?
Well, there's so many adventures that happen in the book that are not in the motion picture. The motion picture concentrated primarily on the Wicked Witch. I mean, the threat of her all the way through, but Dorothy has a lot of other dangers to overcome. And even after the wizard has disappeared in his balloon, Dorothy goes south to see Glinda. So there are a number of chapters, more adventures that she goes through to find Glinda, who will then send her back home. There's still another phase of it that is not covered in the motion picture.
We have a group of second graders from Cottage Hill Elementary School who did go back and read the book. They said they loved it. Mm-hmm. And they said if they could speak to Mr. Baum, they would ask him a few questions. So I want you to have a chance to answer some of the kids' questions. So let's listen to a few of them.
I am Anders, and I was wondering why he didn't make Toto talk.
Well, L. Frank Baum later explained that in Tick-Tock of Oz, the seventh Oz book, Toto was actually asked why he never talked in Oz. And he said he had nothing to say.
Oh, easy as that.
Well, of course, Oz is a place where animals talk. The Cowardly Lion has no problem speaking. You know, it's also possible that Toto he was born in America and dogs in America don't talk.
I was also wondering if the book is called The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, why does Oz turn out to be such a humbug?
I think Baum is dealing with irony, of course. And, there's irony throughout the book. But he was emphasizing self-reliance. You see that with the Scarecrow, Tomb, and Cowardly Lion. They all have the gifts that they seek. They just don't have a tangible symbol of what they want. Dorothy also has to go out and seek what she wants, and nothing stops her. She's probably the first typical American girl in children's literature in that she's very assertive. Nothing dissuades her. She knows what she wants to do, and she goes out and gets it. And I think Baum's emphasizing this, that you have the powers within you all along. You just have to test them and discover them for yourself.
Didn't think about that Dorothy was a real first in that sense.
Well, what's curious is, Ms. Magazine, when they were first founded, published a reading list called Books for Free Children. And the earliest published one on the list was The Wizard of Oz. And Ms. published the first feminist analysis of The Wizard of Oz. And ever since, Wizard of Oz has been considered a very important landmark in Indian feminist children's literature.
The second graders from Cottage Hill Elementary School sent in great questions. I'm going to add one more. When L. Frank Baum wrote this book, did he know that it would have legs, that it would be a smash success?
I think he knew it was a special book, because if you look at the preface, he said that he wanted to create a new, modernized fairy tale. He thought he was introducing something very new to children's literature. He wanted to eliminate the stereotyped genie, dwarf, and fairy, as he said, that you find in Grimm, Andersen, and other traditional fairy tales. He wanted one based upon American materials. So you have a little girl from Kansas rather than the Black Forest or from London. And Dorothy meets all sorts of things that she would have met in, living in the United States. A scarecrow, a man made out of tin, a mechanical man. A cowardly lion or a lion she'd probably see in a zoo or a circus. And even the wicked witches are different from what you find in European fairy tales. For example, the Wicked Witch of the West carries an umbrella, And of course, we know why that is. It's much more practical if you're going to be melted than carrying around a broom.
I'm melting! Melting! Oh, what a world! What a world!
Michael Patrick Hearn is a children's book historian and editor of The Annotated Wizard of Oz. I'm Michelle Norris. Our next Backseat Book Club book is Lunch Lady and the Cyborg Substitute by Jarrett Krasoska. And kids, if you're reading along, please send questions our way at backseatbookclub@npr.org.
Somewhere over the
support for NPR's Backseat Book Club comes from Subaru, introducing the all-new 2014 Forester. Love, it's what makes a Subaru a Subaru. Learn more at Subaru.com.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
The literary magazine Granta releases its Best Young British Novelists issue today. Past issues have helped launch the careers of some of Britain's best-known writers. This year's list includes poet and novelist Sarah Hall. Granta's editor John Freeman describes her this way.
She's not yet 40 and she's published 5 books. Quite productive career for someone so young. And as she's gone on, I think her language has deepened and richened so that she's not just a writer of the landscape. She's a writer of atmosphere.
And you can feel that in this selection that Sarah Hall read for us. It's from her novel in progress called The Reservation.
It's not often she dreams about them. Through the day, they are elusive, keeping to the tall grass of the reservation, disappearing from the den site. They are fleet or lazy, moving through their own tawny colorscape, sleeping under logs, missable either way. Their vanishing acts have been perfected. At night, they come back. The cameras pick them up, red-eyed, heads lowered, muzzles darkened, returning from a hunt. Or she hears them howling along the buffer zone, a long harmonic, one leading, then many. At night, there is no need to imagine, no need to dream. They reign outside the mind.
Sarah Hall, who are these mysterious howling beasts?
Oh, they're wolves. It's not a zombie novel or anything, I'm afraid, although that would probably sell a gazillion.
Yeah, they're really an enigma, at least in the excerpt that we have in Granta here. But why not use the term wolf?
Well, I mean, I have occasionally. I suppose it's just I have a kind of resistance for using names, even with main characters. They end up being he and she quite a lot. So perhaps it's that same tick that I have. I mean, you do have the actual names of wolves in packs as well. So things like Left Paw or Tungsten. Mm-hmm. So you do get actual names too.
You know, I was struck reading this because we're living in an age where we read so much on Twitter or blogs, and there's so much brevity. And, you know, your language, just the imagery, it's just you take time, and it's so beautiful. I'm reading just a part. In the rain, the Redstone Manor looks patched and bloody. Is there a feeling that you're doing something that's becoming more and more rare, you know, in our day?
Well, I don't know, really. I mean, I assume that all writers aspire to wield language in a successful way so that you're creating a kind of precise imagery and an atmosphere at the same time. And you have to have a respect for the language and an understanding of its musicality and its structures, its rhythms, what can be done with it, because it's not just about calling a table a table. I think maybe in the last 20 years or so, both in America and the UK, there's maybe an idea that beauty is somehow suspicious. It doesn't necessarily accurately represent the world. But I think there's probably room for beautiful writing, whatever that means, and other kinds of writing.
And Sarah, just if I can, let me ask you to just give us the plot of The Reservation.
The novel isn't finished. It's about a third to half of the way through so far. And I'm not a writer that plots too heavily right up at the front. But the general scenario is the character of Rachel is working on a reservation in Idaho with a wolf pack there. And she is wooed by an earl to come back to the UK and oversee a project that he's running. He's very involved with a self-sustaining wolf enclosure. I don't entirely know where things are going, so that's quite exciting. I mean, I can say something here and not necessarily hold myself to it.
That's true. Yeah.
In fact, you know what? I'm going to change it to bears, not even wolves. Not even wolves. Let's scrap that.
There we go. Sarah Hall, she's one of the young writers featured in Granta's latest issue of Young British Writers. Sarah, thank you.
Thanks very much.
And Granta's Best Young British Novelists issue is out today in the UK. We'll have it in the United States next week.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. Two high school sophomores, Ethan Wincoop and Tiana Chen, sneak away from their homes in suburban Washington, D.C. and fly to Hong Kong. They're searching for Tiana's father, a Chinese dissident who believes China is just a spark away from democratic revolution. He's gone missing after landing in Hong Kong, and Tiana is determined to find out what happened. This is the plot of a new young adult novel, a thriller, based on a true story. It's written by Fred Hyatt. He's the editorial page editor of The Washington Post. And Fred joins me here in the studio, along with the young woman who inspired the book, 23-year-old Tiana Wong. Welcome to you both. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Tiana, your name tells a story in itself, right? Tell us about that.
Yes, I was born in 1989, and my father, being a democracy activist, he was paying a lot of attention to what was going on in Tiananmen, Beijing at that time. So after the massacre, he named me Tiana to commemorate the victims of the Tiananmen Square massacre, and also to celebrate the ideals of freedom and democracy. He really wanted to remember their courage.
Let's talk a bit more about your dad, Wong Bingzhang. He was a Chinese exile, moved to Canada, right, where you grew up, left a career in medicine to become a very prominent democracy activist. And like the father in Fred's book, he went on a trip and disappeared. You were 13 at the time?
Correct.
And what did you piece together later about what happened to him?
In 2002, my father went on a trip to Vietnam. He was hoping to meet with labor activists near the Chinese-Vietnamese border when he was kidnapped and forced into China on a boat. He was, you know, blindfolded, beaten, gagged, and then left at a temple to be picked up by Chinese police within minutes of being left there. So that's the story that he told us.
Yeah. And he's been held as a prisoner in China ever since. It's been more than 10 years now.
Correct. He was, after his arrest, he was subsequently charged with terrorism and espionage. He had a one-day trial and then found guilty of those charges and sentenced to life in prison.
Fred Hyatt, how did you find out about Tiana and her father's story?
Well, I'd heard about Wong, but I hadn't really focused on him until late 2008 when, at the Washington Post, we received a beautiful op-ed about his case, which happened to be written by Tiana Wong, who at the time was just out of high school and had come to Washington to spend a year to try and bring attention to her father's case. So I read the op-ed, we published it, and then I asked if she wanted to get a cup of coffee. I just wanted to meet this obviously unusual young person.
And what struck you about the piece that Tiana wrote and about meeting her for the first time?
Well, it struck me as quite courageous that she had left Montreal and moved to Washington really without any contacts. And I think I was also struck by the name and the expectation. Of course, it's a beautiful name and it's beautiful to commemorate the democracy aspirations of Tiananmen Square, but also what a burden for a young person to have to live up to, in a sense. And I think that struck me.
Does it feel like a burden to you, Tiana, to have a name that has the resonance of that massacre in Tiananmen Square?
I guess a little bit. It feels more like a responsibility. I think in the novel, the fictional Tiana and I feel like, given the circumstance, you know, in her case, the father's disappearance, and in my case, my father's imprisonment, it's kind of inescapable that we feel like we have to respond to sort of the responsibility that was given to us that's embedded in our names. Yeah. Mm.
Fred, how did you decide to turn this story into this novel for young adults?
It sort of decided itself for me. I started that summer without a great plan, working on a young adult novel. And I thought it was going to be the story of Ethan and his adventure in Asia. And as I wrote, the Tiana character, which I appropriated at the time without permission or without even telling or asking Tiana, just kind of became a more and more important part of the story until really it was a story of the two of them and their friendship and the adventure they go on together.
When you first saw Fred's novel, Tiana, and realized that this was based on you and your story had been turned into fiction, what was that experience like for you?
Well, it took me completely by surprise. you know, the conversations about human rights in China, they can be a little numbingly familiar after you talk about it. You say the same sort of things about what's going on with your father, and in fact, there's not that much progress, and there's a lot of, it's marked by a lot of stagnation. So having a book and finding a new creative approach to talking about human rights issues, it's really inspiring for me, too.
Tiana, tell us about the latest you've heard from your dad or about your dad. What's his condition?
The last letter I got a month and a half ago, he told us that was, you know, there's a part that's directed specifically for me because he only gets one letter a month. And so he writes a really long letter, and then there are sections of it for each member of my family.
He's only allowed to write one letter a month.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. On one hand, he's really encouraging of whatever it is that I want to do. On the other hand, you know, he also has his own ideas of what I should do with my life. But the part that I remember the most from the last letter was that he apologized for the amount of pain that he's caused my family, you know, in the last 10 years. But also said that he had no regrets because he felt like he responded to his calling. Yeah.
That must have been really hard to read.
Yeah.
Hmm. What have you heard about his health?
I think his psychological health is what worries my family more than anything. He himself is losing hope in the possibility of freedom, and you know, that's really difficult.
Mm-hmm. Is your father's case on the radar at the State Department?
Yes, yes.
It is?
Yeah.
And what have you heard?
Well, they raised his case, you know, at whenever there's high-level meetings, you know, and there's an opportunity to talk about human rights issues. There's a standard list of prisoners that they hand over, and my father is somewhere on that list. I don't exactly know what order, but yeah.
Fred Hyatt, do you have any hope or expectation that this book will raise the level of attention to Tiana's father's case?
I do hope that. And Tiana and I each wrote afterwards for this book, and Tiana's is quite beautiful. But I think we'd both be very happy to write different afterwards for the paperback. Mm. You know, what I hope that people who read the book will get the idea that there's really no reason for this man who's now 66, right, to be in prison. And, you know, there is new leadership in China, and I think we can hope that as they consolidate, maybe they'll take a slightly different attitude towards some of these questions.
Fred Hyatt, author of the young adult thriller 9 Days, and Tiana Wong, daughter of Wang Bingzhang, who inspired the book. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for having us.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Okay, let's summarize what little is known about yesterday's attack in Boston. 3 people are dead, well over 100 injured. Investigators say the attack was so generic in nature that it's not easy to identify suspects. We heard our colleague Dina Temple-Raston report the improvised explosive devices were unsophisticated enough that many people could have made them, and police have no person of interest in custody.
As investigators do their work, we are also keeping a longer perspective in mind. Our next conversation is about the Middle East and the United States' rivalry with China. After President Obama took office in 2009, the Mideast scholar Vali Nasser was appointed as an advisor to veteran diplomat Richard Holbrooke, special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan.
Vali Nasser writes about that experience in a new book called The Dispensable Nation. He describes a disillusioning experience in which he saw Holbrooke frozen out by the president's inner circle, for whom he believes diplomacy is a lost art. Vali Nasser says the U.S. is looking to reduce its role in the world while China is primed to fill the void. What is China doing to extend its influence in that part of the world?
China is very interested in the energy supplies of the Middle East. Oil and gas are extremely important not only to China's overall economic development, but to the development of Western China and Central China as increasingly population and industry moves westward in China. The Chinese are also very worried about the Central Asian republics, Afghanistan and Pakistan, because they think that ultimately those countries can have an influence on political developments in Western China. And generally, the Chinese look at Western Asia, that is all the way to the Mediterranean, as part of Greater Asia. When you tell Americans what they think when they say Asia, they're talking about from Southeast Asia to Northeast Asia, from North Korea to Indonesia. And therefore, we are trying to pivot east, supposedly leave the Middle East, where we have actually a very strong anchor, to go to China's backyard in Asia, whereas the Chinese are pivoting west.
I want to translate that a little bit just because people are trying to put this map in their heads. You're saying that when we think of Asia as Americans, we're thinking of that Pacific coastline of
Asia,
pretty
much. That's right, Asia-Pacific.
And the Chinese are thinking about the largest continent in the world and everything in it and all the interests all the way across it.
Exactly. And everything that's been happening in recent years accentuates this. The need for Central Asian and Persian Gulf oil and gas, the need for markets. When you look at Chinese railway building investment, is to connect Turkey to Iran, to Pakistan, and then on to Western China.
You look at a map that puts them practically in the Persian Gulf if they're in that port.
Practically in the Persian Gulf, and that raises important questions for the U.S. One is that if we are globally competing with China all the way from Africa, Latin America, and then Asia, why would we abandon the Middle East and leave it to the Chinese essentially to gradually fill that vacuum? And secondly, are we really reconciled to the Chinese one day refereeing the Arab-Israeli issue, or the Chinese handling Al-Qaeda, or the Chinese refereeing disputes between Iran and Saudi Arabia? And therefore, our conception of this idea that all the game in the world is happening in East Asia and the Asia-Pacific is at odds with the way I think the Chinese are looking at the global reality, which is pushing them westward.
So you think the United States is in some ways abandoning this region. Your next point was that China may be putting itself into a position that it would be the referee of disputes in the Persian Gulf or in the Middle East. Really?
Once you leave the bubble of Washington, the impression of the region is that we are retreating on the double.
But are the Chinese really stepping in?
The Chinese will eventually be drawn in. It's not that the Chinese are looking to come in. But the Chinese clearly don't see Middle East as a declining, diminishing strategic asset. To them, it is a growing strategic asset. Now, I don't think that our calculations about the Middle East are correct. I don't think Middle East's strategic value is declining. In fact, at the moment, we can see that the Middle East is valiantly trying to defeat President Obama's foreign policy.
The Middle East is valiantly trying to defeat President Obama's foreign policy.
Because it's creating crisis after crisis, which makes it impossible for the administration to ignore the region and to be able to say that this idea that we brought the troops out of Iraq, we brought the troops out of Afghanistan, now we can very happily move to Asia, is just not happening. The president went on a highly touted trip to Burma, and in the middle of it, the Secretary of State had to fly back to Jerusalem in order to, you know, end the fighting in Gaza. The president is being forced to focus on Syria. We are seeing increasingly that Asian countries are getting nervous because they think the way U.S. role in Middle East is playing out may be egging on countries like North Korea or China in adopting a more belligerent posture. So, you know, when you go out of the United States, the debate is very different. People there see a United States that is timid, reluctant to get engaged, and particularly they look at the Middle East. This is a place where the U.S. said for a decade is of critical consequence to its security, to its foreign policy. And now, all of a sudden, the message is that we really have no real vital interests here anymore. And we don't see conflicts in Syria any different from conflict in Congo. And we don't want to get involved in Congo. We don't want to get involved in Syria. And that creates...
I should mention, you're paraphrasing an actual quote by the president in an interview with the New Republic.
Which was quite consequential in the region. That was heard very loud and clear, that we're diminishing the importance of the region to the way we look at Central Africa, which also has conflicts and humanitarian crises. Well, that would force leaders in the region to say, okay, if you are not going to be here and the Chinese have interest here or the Russians have interest here, we're going to begin looking there.
You have called this book The Dispensable Nation. Provocative title. What do you mean by that?
President Clinton used the term indispensable nation.
To describe us.
To describe us, that we are indispensable to world order, to world security. Even if we err and we overreach, the world without us would be less liberal, more conflictual, and no country has the convening power or the stabilizing power of the United States. And it is our mandate and our duty and responsibility to exercise that leadership. When you go outside the United States, it's very clear that the U.S. does not want to live up to that responsibility and duty. And it is happy, particularly in the Middle East, to play a less important role, to no longer be the stabilizer, no longer the provider of security. And I think that basically means that we no longer want to be the indispensable nation. And I think it's important for Americans to consider what that means. Is that really where we want to go? And would that make the world a safer, more prosperous place?
Wally Nesser, the book is The Dispensable Nation. Thanks very much for coming by.
Thank you.